Thank you very much. So first of all, thanks to Marc Billon and Nicolas Lechoupier for inviting me. It is a pleasure to be here, and it's also great to speak after this introduction into surveillance medicine by David Armstrong, and I'm very much looking forward to going into a discussion. I will be talking today about the materiality of surveillance medicine. So I'm interested in technologies, datascapes, but also the notion of temporality, in particular in epidemiology. So I want to reflect about surveillance medicine, about health datascapes, about population registries and individual identification numbers, and shift to look at surveillance medicine as an infrastructure for contemporary rationality. So epidemiology also has become a technique of reflexive social learning or social engineering for developing healthcare systems. And this is key in societies that claim to constantly improve by learning from the past. Also, like, there's this notion of reflexive modernity coined by Ulrich Beck. So I'm interested in taking a closer look at the temporal regimes in these practices with data, because technically the prerequisite for all these regimes is of learning is data, and the range of topics in this seems to be without limits. So I start with my case study, and that will be a case study on data infrastructures for population health in Denmark. Do urban bus and tramway drivers die earlier than the rest of the population? Does air pollution cause heart disease? Does the frequent usage of cell phones increase cancer risk in the population? Are blood samples from donors who get diagnosed with cancer safe to use? These are just some of those questions put to test in late 20th century epidemiological science using population registries in Denmark. So my talk is about routines of surveillance medicine, about record keeping, data mining, and recombination of new and old data and samples in epidemiologic research practice. Recently, there has been much debate over big data in the life sciences, in particular for newly emerging research fields such as bioinformatics, genomics, metabolomics. But similar debates also occurred as to digital surveillance more broadly. So today, I focus on the history of big data in a small country that is on nationwide databases that centrally store individual level information in Denmark. So I look into the history of these data infrastructures and follow their manifold usages to explore and discuss the ways in which these data come to be layered when used more than one time and recombined with other data. I'm interested in the emerging datascapes, and this is a term that is inspired by Apadurai's ethnoscapes and mediascapes, financescapes, and in my case, it is about the datascapes of population health surveillance. As to the notion of data, I mostly refer to data as numerical data, as numbers. This is the stuff epidemiologists work with. The formal definition also of epidemiology is the science of the determinants and distribution of health and disease and population. So it's a very numerical and statistical understanding of a discipline. And it is also a reflection of my own practice, having worked for many years as a practitioner of epidemiology, that what epidemiologists do is to collect and store numbers and columns of numbers in databases and organize data with categorized variables in different formats. They clean and parse and then subject these data to statistical hypothesis testing and risk modeling. So with this focus on numbers, it might be helpful to distinguish two rough functions of numbers and numerical data. And here I follow a recent distinction proposed by sociologists Wendy Espeland and Mitchell Stevens, who distinguish first numbers as identifiers or markers, and second, numbers that commensurate, that render measures. And these measures are always bound to calculative techniques. So for the issue of data recombination in epidemiology, both kinds of numbers play a key role. And I will discuss numerical data that identify first and then address numbers that come out of calculative devices. So first, numbers as identifiers, and I now come back to my case study of Danish population registries. So among the first things you do when you relocate to Denmark as a new resident is paying a visit to the office of the Central Population Registry to obtain a number that is called the CPR number. So it's the Central Population Registry number, and on the left-hand side you can see the logo of this office. If you don't get that number, as one quickly finds out, it is impossible to make arrangements for employment or housing or to open a bank account. I quote, "This number will follow you through your life in Denmark," end of quote, is what new residents hear at that office of the Central Population Registry upon receiving this personal 10-digit CPR number that starts with date of birth and then has three random numbers and one number that by being even or odd also indicates gender. Right at the CPR office, new residents choose a general practitioner whose name is printed together with the resident's name and the CPR number and address on the so-called yellow CPR card. And this is actually my own card from when I lived in Denmark as a resident to do my postdoc for about 4 years. So receiving this number, it takes some days until the plastic card is sent out, but the number itself spreads even more quickly through contracts for employment and housing, the pension fund, electricity companies or telephone companies, the local library or a sponsored language course who all ask for that particular number. So introduced in 1968, this is a picture from the introduction of the CPR number. This number has played a central role in everyday life ever since. Like elsewhere in Scandinavia, population registries have a long history in church records and in cameralism, a sort of a state bookkeeping science originally developed in Sweden. In its 20th century format, the Danish Central Population Registry dates back to the interwar period when the registries were centralized, which were at the municipal level before. The 1924 regulation of population registration actually took shape in the context of food rationing after World War I. And it was replaced in 1968 by a new law that was tied to new developments in electronic data processing. After the new law passed Parliament in the context of a tax reform in 1968, each resident was assigned such a unique individual ID number, a practice Danish rule also later introduced in Greenland and in the Faroe Islands a few years later. Since then, CPR numbers have become ubiquitous in everyday life, used in each and every interaction between individuals and the public services, from employment to healthcare, and these data generate a continuously growing data archive. Information infrastructures of the welfare state at the same time became laboratories for both information technology and social science and public health research. So system developers in the 1960s envisioned the unique CPR number as a general catalyst for mechanization in the public and private sectors, moving from paper and punch card technologies to magnetic tape and electronic data processing. System developers designed closely interlinked central and local databases and regular synchronization between municipality and the central registries. It was hoped that automation would achieve the higher speed and produce less errors. And also the labor that was involved in electronic data processing changed then a lot. This was a different kind of labor, more qualified labor. And as you can see, like in the early 20th century statistics, there is a lot of female labor also involved in these positions. So this new generation of developers worked on managing circuits and data flows and communication loops in order to optimize the system along a few major issues that they had identified. And these included integration of different databases, automation of identity checks, error management, and completeness. So information technology became an engineering discipline. And the CPR system that was adopted in 1968 was conceptualized in that very context. It was one of their suggestions of how to make administrative operations more efficient at a much more general level. These new techniques were adopted with hardly any controversy by Parliament in late 1967, in the context of the tax reform that introduced taxation at income. To system developers, this though was just the beginning. They envisioned beyond the infrastructure for elections, schooling, conscription lists, and tax, what they called the total EDP system, electronic data processing system from tomorrow, as they put it here on a slide at an international conference on population registration. As you can read here in the last lines, they held that the technical development is years ahead of the user's capability to utilize it. Like the manifold applications they promised to the municipalities and the administration, this infrastructure of the CPR system brought about new research opportunities for researchers in Denmark. And in 1982, researchers from the Danish Institute for Clinical Epidemiology published a book that advertised and called for broad usage of this Danish registry landscape for public health studies. The registries at that time comprised more than 60 health-related and 15 administrative registries at the central level, really storing individual data for the entire population. So, and this completeness was part of a new dream of the epidemiologists and of surveillance medicine. And here is an overview of how usage of these registries in risk factor epidemiology was envisioned, which I won't go into in much detail today. I would just like to quote from the book that these epidemiologists published at the time on what they envisioned as the usage of population registries, and I quote, "We in Denmark perhaps have a particular obligation to apply the registries in a positive way, among other aspects for research purposes. Few countries in the world have possibilities that are as great for epidemiological oriented registry research as we do in Denmark." End of quote. So in a way, health scientists early on saw an imperative in putting to use this data wealth for medical research and healthcare planning. They called it an ethical duty vis-a-vis an international community of health scientists and international organizations. data mining practice would take advantage of the bureaucratic infrastructure in order to produce facts on population health sought after by medical doctors, but also public health planners and policymakers. The authors listed the first registries, such as the criminological registry operated by the police, the central psychiatric registry established in 1938, the twin registry in Denmark was in operation since 1954, covering birth cohorts back to the 1870s. More health registries then were founded in the 1970s. For example, the National Danish Hospital Registry stores complete data on all hospital admissions from 1977 onwards and was later extended to also include outpatient and emergency data. A little later, a prescription registry was introduced. And these resources, these data infrastructures, gained prominence in biomedical research, in particular during the 1990s, especially when genomics and genomic epidemiology took off. For instance, the New York Times report, a goldmine of psychiatric data discovered in Danish registry. So, and here the American author points to Denmark's unparalleled combination of a universal social welfare system and obsessive record keeping, which is now very useful for the new epidemiological science informed by genomics, because a lot of these registries were also linked to what then became to be called biobanks, like collections of samples that simply had been retained. And it was with regard to the national birth cohort set up in the late 1990s that the journal Science feature story titled in amazement, quote, "When the entire country is a cohort," and again, the epidemiologist's dream, Denmark. So this is another dream of medicine, of surveillance medicine, to take up what David introduced in his talk. While attention came mainly from North American media, mainly US institutions, Danish researchers and science journalists actively promoted the capacities of those infrastructures as well. Many US researchers sought collaboration with Danish epidemiologists to get access. One should stress here that the access policy is not only for publicly funded researchers, but also for private sectors like marketing and pharmaceutical companies became liberalized during the 1990s. And international researchers have boasted about these data. And as a French historian of epidemiology, Luc Berlivet, also once recalled, there were a host of seminar jokes by lecturers of epidemiology throughout the world. And Berlivet actually provides an example of a lecturer's remark during an epidemiology course he attended in London. Quote, "In Denmark, you take a seat on a chair in a public place, and immediately there are a lot of sensors that measure a lot of things, and the data go directly into a central computer," end of quote. So this is symptomatic of the data hunger, the amazement, but also sometimes the envy and critique among researchers as to this mode of population surveillance. Denmark, of course, was neither the only nor the first country to implement such a central identification number as such. And in many ways, the CPR number corresponds to social security numbers in other countries. What is particular about Denmark is the extent of its usage, its significance in everyday life, and the degree of linkage enabled by this ID number. For instance, conducting a census shifted away from carrying out surveys to the task of how to retrieve the data that were already there in registries through linkage of the information from the different registries that held data. And the tool to do that kind of record linkage was the individual CPR number, because this was the number that was present and in each and every of these registries. In fact, Denmark was the first country to carry out a census-based registry-based census based entirely on the registry infrastructure in 1981 without approaching a single citizen and literally unnoticed by the population. And this practice really drew international attention, expressed, for example, in the Journal of Official Statistics of 1986, which featured an article titled, "Which country will follow the Scandinavian lead in taking a register-based census of the population?" So CPR numbers and their usage produced a continually growing archive of information that records and stores information on individual interaction between citizens and the state, as well as many service companies. I argue that both the welfare state concept in which these registries were built and the role of the public services in the welfare state with its data keeping routines and the traceability of individual data co-shape the approaches taken in the empirical social sciences and in particular in public health research in Denmark. The registry infrastructure is one such health data scape that became a promising and busy research platform for biomedical research. Population registries in a Scandinavian state like Denmark, with a national healthcare system funded by taxes, faced new developments with budget cuts in the welfare state and a reorientation with the liberalization of the healthcare sector that took place during the late 1980s and 1990s. And this also paved the way for more transnational usage of these data infrastructures. And all these developments reconfigured how these like infrastructures that emerged during the welfare state period were used from the 1990s onwards. So this was the first part about the numbers that identify and was really developed around this central population registry number, the CPR number. And I move on now to numbers that emerge from calculative devices. With respect to the genomics-based industry, Mike Fortune coined the expression of an economy of promises into which these data feed. How do these modes of promises, these future-oriented rationalities, work in practice? How do the knowledge brokers of contemporary epidemiology and genomics deal with the data that are out there? Let's have a look at two examples from the Danish case again. In the mid-1990s, Danish and US epidemiologists carried out a collaborative investigation into the cancer risk of cell phone usage. And they had obtained joint funding for that by both foundations from Denmark and from the US, and also from the companies providing cell phone contracts in Denmark at the time. Here's the publication that came out of the study. Was published in 2001. The objective was to address concern over the health effects of electromagnetic exposure. First, researchers retrieved a list of all those who had a cellular phone contract in Denmark between 1982, this was when cell phones had become commercially available, and 1995. So it was a 14-year period that researchers decided to study using company data from the then two cell phone companies who were doing business in Denmark, which was Tele Denmark Mobile and Sonofon. With the CPR numbers of individual users as listed in the company's records, they were able to link these individuals via the CPR number to the data of the cancer registry in order to find out whether cell phone contract holders had been diagnosed with cancer in these 14 years. And as you might know, the Danish Cancer Registry, founded in 1943, was the first registry of that kind at the national level and gained international attention, also setting standards for cancer registration worldwide. So the scholars involved, the researchers involved in setting up the cancer registry in Denmark then also were very influential in cancer registration activities at the level of the World Health Organization later. To estimate the relative increase in cancer risk in this group of cell phone users, cancer rates among the users were compared to the background rates for the whole of Denmark in a standardized way, as it is usually done in cohort studies, like also accounting for age and gender. And as we had heard before, like the entire country was a cohort, like when you take these registry data at the central level that hold information at the individual level, then they could like compare this cohort of cell phone users that they had identified to the entire Danish population. And what comes out of these studies in analytical epidemiology are estimates of relative risks as measures of effect that compare differently exposed groups. So these are the numbers that commensurate and that provide quantitative measures. And if in this situation, then a complete population registry infrastructure study showed no effect, as it was actually the case, or no significant effect in the cell phone study, the researchers concluded that with the absence of significant increases in cancer incidence among cell phone users, there was no need of a regulation. So it was the infrastructure and the record linkage capacity of the CPR numbers that made possible this investigation. There were also issues of data protection, issues of consent, and like often for register studies, like the censuses that are being carried out without contacting a single individual, researchers initially did not ask for individual permission or informed consent. And later, when the study got published in the media, then this attracted public attention. And in the article published in the US Journal of the National Cancer Institute, the author stated that their study, quote, was based entirely on record linkage and no one was aware of whether he or she was included. However, once the study had been announced in the media and triggered inquiries, the two telephone companies published in their quarterly reports a notice that subscribers could contact them if they wished to be excluded. And what happened was that only a low number, 53 out of 420,000, opted out. And this in turn then became drawn upon in order to stress that there is a huge trust in the public services and a great general support for scientific studies in Denmark's population. So these kind of exercises in inferential statistics reshuffle registry data into observational study designs and predictive modeling, and then also into platforms for interventions or non-intervention. Another example, the National Institutes of Health in the US, in collaboration with Danish and Swedish researchers, empirically tested whether blood transfusion was safe if a donor shortly after the blood donation would be diagnosed with cancer. By retrospectively designing a quasi-experiment run on this population registry infrastructure, all donors and recipients were traced via the CPR numbers in the healthcare system, and a decade after the blood transfusion, followed up for their disease experience. So again, all this took place exclusively via registry data mining and recombination of existing records. In this way, health scientists mobilized the long history of record keeping in Scandinavia as a resource for knowledge production. And in bioinformatics, we know that notion of in silico experimentation. And I think this epidemiological quasi-experiment can sort of be compared to that in silico experimentation, like using computers or doing modeling of experiments with existing data. In a way, avant la lettre, avant there was bioinformatics, and before there was like in silico experimentation or the term. So record linkage and data recombination work not only as with data repositories of population health, they also became performative, as I like to call it, in co-shaping the ways in which societies act upon public health in the digital era. Again, how does this take place? I would like to have a look at one example of new kinds of software and self-testing that are being developed and updated to better translate epidemiological evidence into an optimized practice and increasingly also proactive self-management, which has a great deal of impact in subject formation in our societies. So for instance, epidemiologists use data to translate results into risk scores. These are algorithms then used in clinical decision making and preventive medicine. So here's an example of such a tool. It's called PRECARD, a tool for evidence-based prevention that was used in preventive counseling for cardiovascular disease, especially secondary prevention, but also physicians began to apply it for primary prevention. And there are also similar internet tools available. And how it works is that the doctor or the patient, citizen, enters measurements like blood pressure, like height and weight and cholesterol levels. And then the software would calculate risks of stroke and myocardial infarction based on a profile of variables. And the algorithm actually comes from epidemiological cohort studies, three cohort studies that were conducted in Denmark from the 1960s to the 1980s, and uses this follow-up in order to compute risk factors. So it performs sort of an individualization of individual patients or citizens by enrolling them into the population experience, interestingly enough, of the past decades, but then projecting a probability of individual disease for that particular person. And the tool PRECARD also has a function to calculate risk reduction for the lifestyle modification that is supposed to follow a consultation between the doctor and patient. And this is visualized in these kinds of graphs as a risk reduction from red to yellow. So the software developers also collaborated with computer scientists, but then also with psychologists specialized in health communication in order to develop that software, which is actually an early version, an early local version in Denmark of the risk score that you might have come across that is called HARD score, that is in broad use in Europe. And it was initially envisioned as being the third party present in the consultation room, so that it was no longer the doctor, the physician, who would embody the expert knowledge, but here was the expert knowledge, and then aside from that, doctor and patient would negotiate decisions about treatment or decisions about prevention. And this is very much resonating with the developments in evidence-based medicine and also personalized medicine. And more recently, these tools also attempt to integrate biomarkers in that kind of profiling, which they haven't done that much so far because it was found that it didn't improve the predictive capacity of these tools. So this is one way of how epidemiological risk assessment contributed to transforming patients and citizens into both active contributors to and consumers of data and statistical evidence. Epidemiological surveillance spanned a whole range of a quiet mode of unnoticeable monitoring and census taking by the state to practices that enrolled and later actively engaged communities and participant citizens who as individuals did not opt out but at times indeed wanted to contribute to health research. So epidemiological studies and practices of predictive modeling have shaped what the actual healthcare system and policy looks like today. They not only model risks, but also remodel the population. Thus, they have become performative. And this performative approach that I propose in order to trace the social life of epidemiological data is inspired by the notion of performativity that Donald McKenzie and Michel Calon developed for economic modeling. And their analysis extends to performativity beyond speech acts to describe calculative devices in econometrics as performative in shaping actual markets. Building on this notion of performativity, Calon and Muneza later follow the ways calculative devices play out in economic experimentation and price setting, analyzing the calculative process itself in its rationality, both in context, in the trajectories, and also in processes of negotiation in everyday lives of producers and consumers of data. So it is in that sense that I see the pre-card tool as performatively co-shaping individual modes of prevention and optimization. And as Calon and Muneza have outlined three steps of this calculative process, I think that approach might also be helpful for us to think about surveillance medicine and big data in the health sciences. So their first step relates to the detachment of entities and their arrangement in a single space. When we think of epidemiology, this corresponds to collecting and bringing together data from different contexts and different domains into one database and then into one quantitative risk model. Their second step denotes the implementation of a common operating principle that enables comparison across a variety of calculative spaces. For epidemiology here, we could identify such a comparative space in practices such as meta-analysis and systematic reviews of existing studies, which have become a research direction of their own. The third step described by Calon and Muneza is about producing new entities able to leave the calculative space without taking with it the whole methodological apparatus. In epidemiology, it is the risk estimates and sometimes these kinds of assessment tools themselves, like risk scores or sets of biomarkers that travel to consumers, clinicians, and policymakers who use them according to their own agendas and practices. So these risk estimates become extremely mobile across context and level of analysis. The Danish CPR system functioned as a testing ground for novel techniques, administrative efficiency, and technology-mediated governance. In a veritable data bank optimism, as Lee and Roald Hansen put it for the case of Norway, systems of automation and rational infrastructures were designed for all domains of society. Together with the existing registries, the CPR number made possible unprecedented record linkage to a host of distributed databases, including medical registries. Public health scientists found in data linkage novel opportunities for population health research. By combining these mundane information infrastructures, it became possible, as an epidemiologist put it in 2004, to, quote, follow the Dane from the cradle to the grave. Another reference to the temporality. And in the age of genomics, this became a resource for pharmaceutical research, pharmacogenomics, for example. Biobanking and databasing for genomic futures became prominent, including profitable ones, especially in the pharmaceutical industry and in the neoliberalization of the health sector, also in Scandinavian countries. In the era of genomics, some Danish pharmacoepidemiologists also advertised these very data infrastructures, like the state population registries, as a research for transnational resource for transnational research, offering the Danish registry data as a control population for an internationalized epidemiology. Yet how these data are actually put to use varies and follows a host of different agendas at the same time. For instance, the very same data that were used to find find profitable genetic markers, or it was hoped for that they would be economically profitable for cancer susceptibility testing, have also been put to use within environmental and social epidemiology agendas. So secondary usage of old serum samples in Denmark, for example, enabled retrospective investigation of past exposures to organochloride and associations with breast cancer at the population level, making these data speak to issues of environmental health, ubiquitous chemicals, and issues of regulation as well. So looking more closely into these manifold ways in which population registries were data mined, epidemiology is a case in point to trace such cascades of record linkage and the performativity of population profiling with distributed data well before the advent of bioinformatics or marketing or social media. At stake in epidemiological surveillance is this co-presencing of the old and the new in the actualization and potentiality of data recombination as ever incomplete and as data hunger that not only reorders knowledge but also co-shapes social relations. And I'd like to conclude by showing an installation that we developed in an art science collaboration at Medical Museum University of Copenhagen, where we try to expose these performativities of surveillance in contemporary biomedicine and beyond. And this installation that was called Mass Observation was on show at the exhibition Split and Splice, Fragments from the Age of Biomedicine, addressing practices of surveillance linking the domain of healthcare, epidemiology, and biomedical research to other technologies of surveillance in the public sphere. So the setup of the installation was a small room with a wall of screens displaying surveillance imagery. There, it was a workplace with a desk and a chair, reminding of security companies and video surveillance at airports or in museums, where we also have it, where 24 hours a day non-selective images are produced. And titled Mass Observation, this installation reassembles a variety of surveillance feeds from different contexts. And I just quickly, to end with, go through them. It's the image of a pill camera voyaging through the human body on the left-hand side. From the top, a live camera from another exhibition room in the museum, an ICSI procedure of in vitro fertilization, microcinematography of human blood cells, and below there is a display of a patient monitor as used in intensive care units, a virtual fly-through of the human body based on the Visible Human Project data, a webcam of the Copenhagen City Hall Square, a data run from epidemiological modeling, and the bottom screens show images recorded by a routine control camera sent through the sewers below the museum, Another screen displays fluctuating stock exchange rates and virtual surgery images. So these are different loops and that run at different speeds and are spatially arranged in a particular way so that they allow the viewer to see new correspondences and connections and allow new questions being asked and raised. So that was what we hoped for as curators. So to show the ubiquity and multiple connections between a variety of surveillance contexts, to expose the surveillance gaze and its mode of presencing far beyond the health sciences context and how they are constitutive of contemporary societies. And I'll close with that. Thank you for your attention.